Welcome to the first of two special episodes in our Work Now and in the Future Tools for Thinking podcast series. Today, we're joined by the renowned Professor Stuart Clegg, a leading sociologist and organizational theorist from the University of Sydney's School of Project Management. Professor Clegg will dive into a fascinating topic, Organizations for Liquid Modern Times, a concept that redefines how we think about the ever-changing dynamics of today's workplaces. For additional materials and resources, visit www.aalto.fi/fi/futurework and navigate to the podcast section. Now, without further ado, let's welcome Professor Stuart Clegg. There is a question about you pointing out that management and organization studies in general is kind of lacking general social theory. Why do you believe organizational researchers should prioritize social theory, and what impact could it have on the field?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's the impact that its absence has had, which is my first concern. And possibly this is something which is partly biographical. My first degree was a long time ago, in the 1960s, at the University of Aston, and I specialized in sociology. And I loved sociological theory. I read it widely, and I think that deep reading that was done then set me on a track to always approach issues from a theoretical perspective. I think it gives a depth of understanding that it isn't there in just working within the parameters of a management or an organization theory. It enables one to connect local situations to more global concerns. C. Wright Mills put it very nicely once when he said, it allows you to connect private issues to public troubles. And that's a very nice formulation. Not that I'm always looking at public troubles, but no. It's the question of trying to connect and of trying to think outside and beyond the case. When I read some of the people that I most admire in the field, this is what they do. And There's a second associated thing, actually, as well. If the state of sort of organization and management theory today, it's become incredibly balkanized and microized. Mm-hmm. It's, you'll meet somebody and they'll say, I'm an institutional logic person, or I do institutional work, or I do institutional entrepreneurship. And each one of those probably hasn't got a clue what the other is doing. They haven't got a broad concept of institutional theory, and they're not really aware of where institutional theory might fit into a gamut of approaches going back at least to Weber. So I think it's important to have that understanding of social theory. That's the first reason. The second reason is social theory can add so much. I was recently talking to a group of project management students on a webinar last week. And we were talking about liquid modernity, mm-hmm. and Zygmunt Bauman's work. And the point I was making to them was that if you look at Bauman's work on liquid modernity, liquid society, and especially you look at his last book, Retrotopia, then it's almost a prescient It's a prescient understanding of where we sit in 2024 with the swing to retrotopic, reactionary right-wing governments, which is occurring globally at the present time, even in Finland, I believe. Yeah. And, one or two holdouts, but it certainly seems to be to be happening. And if you think about the whole ideology of make America great again, then it's very much a retrotopic backward look to an imagined past, which will produce a future in practice, which I suspect will not correspond to that which the people who voted for it imagine it that it will be. There are so many contradictions and paradoxes built into the model of it. Now, all of that's there in, or for me, I understand all of that to be there in Bauman's work. So I find this a really, you know, Zygmunt was a friend and also my favorite social theorist. So I tend to be a little biased, let's say, because I admire the man so much. But yeah, I mean, I think that if we want to understand what's happening in the world right now, social theory, good social theory, really helps us do so.
I couldn't agree more. And I've also recently heard someone say that the management theories of the present don't really, the ones that have been circulated, that they don't really meet the realities of managing at the moment.
Certainly not. I mean, I've never thought most management or organization theory to be very much, it hasn't got much to do with reality, largely because of the methods that are used. You know, using questionnaires, asking people to give you accounts of things is not reality. It's accounts, and accounts differ greatly from reality. One of the fundamental influences on my thinking was reading Garfinkel's studies in ethnomethodology, and reading an ethnomethodological text, and over many, many years being a very good friend of one of my best friends is David Silverman. And I find David's approach really, really refreshing, which is that we have to look empirically at real data. And real data is the data that would have happened even if you were a dead sociologist. You don't create it yourself by asking people questions. It's data which is material, it's embedded, it's real.
Couldn't agree more. This is like, yes, I'm in complete full agreement. My own thesis is in ethnography, and I've been struggling with this like a lot. I completely agree, and I don't believe in this power of asking people questions when you kind of embedded your thoughts in there so that they will tell you what you basically are building them to hear. So couldn't agree more. But you already touched on Bauman, and I have a next question for you on Bauman. So let's move to that, which kind of has to do with all of this that we're anyway talking about here. So you've been discussing analyzing organizations through Bauman's concept of liquid modernity, talking ideas about like lightening of organizations, the reinterization of capitalism and situational organizing. What challenges and opportunities does this shift present in your mind? And what does it demand from employees for them to succeed in such an environment?
It demands a great deal from employees. I put this together with work that's been done by Gerald Davis, who's an American organization theorist, who's done a number of studies pointing out how in the heyday of post-war U.S. capitalism, the American corporation was a kind of quasi-mini state. It provided career. It had pension. It had pensions associated with it. It would have medical benefits, and it would have a career structure. It was something in which people could make their lives with some certainty and some degrees of confidence. Now, clearly, there was a downside to all of this. It was a place full of masculine bias. It was not a world which particularly welcomed women in other than service roles. You know, there were very, very few women in positions of the managerial authority. We're talking about the 1950s, 1960s. Mm. Okay, well, what's happened since about the mid-1970s? I think that historically I would probably date the changes as being precipitated by the stagflation that occurred in much of America and Western Europe after the end of the Vietnam War and its debt financing by the U.S. government. It was then that the fixed exchange rates began to be dropped. money became a much more liquid thing. It was no longer tied to gold. And neoliberal economic ideas began to overtake what had been the predominant Keynesianism of the previous period. So the neoliberalism was, it was not initiated by either Reagan or Thatcher. They became the hallmarks of neoliberalism. Actually, the reason I'm in Australia is because of neoliberalism. In 1976, I was coming off a postdoctoral scholarship and looking for a job. And unfortunately, in the summer of 1976, when I was looking for a job, the International Monetary Fund made an emergency intervention into the British economy, loaning them £3.6 billion with the injunction that they had to impose monetary discipline on their public expenditure. And so actually, monetarism had been introduced into the British economy under the then Callaghan government prior to the advent of Mrs. Thatcher. I mean, she just put the skids, you know, the skates on it. So what was the impact of this? Well, it was firstly a sort of disaggregation of the state. I was saying to someone the other day, I was educated by the state. The state provided the gas and the electricity and the water to my parents' house. The state brought all the mail to the house. None of those things would necessarily be the case today, mm-hmm. because, the garbage was taken away by the state because they were all public sector employees. So the major effect of neoliberalism was to disaggregate, to decompose the public sector and to introduce contractual and private relations into many areas of social life. Okay, so what happened to the careers that people used to have in those old bureaucracies? Well, they're not what they were. I mean, things ain't what they used to be in that reality. The new reality is one of much more opportunity, perhaps, if opportunity to be constantly hustling for projects and hustling for jobs. Opportunities for forms of self-employment, which are not really so much self-employment. They're just kind of a way of offloading lots of responsibilities that employers used to have onto the employee by calling them contractors. And I'm thinking here of things like Uber and all the ubiquitous restaurant delivery bicycles and scooters and motorbikes. The advent of the platform economy has accelerated all of this greatly because the platform economy does two things simultaneously. One, it pulls power to the center because it creates successful platforms are always monopolies. They always have a more or less monopoly control. So it pulls power to the center and to the individuals that control that platform. But at the same time, it kind of under the guise of empowering individuals, which to an extent it does do, because it gives people the choices to make decisions about how and when they work. But it in a historic sense, not necessarily in the sense of that person's biography, but in a historic sense, it disempowers them from employment opportunities that might have existed in the past. Is that clear?
Perfect.
I thought I was getting muddled then.
No. And I'm also thinking that this, again, kind of accentuates the first question, the idea that, you know, when we talk about organizing work management, doing that in a vacuum, like not applying social theory and the change that's taking, like, you know, organizations and management don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in the context of the present societal order. And if you don't introduce that into your thinking, into your theorizing, and your understanding, then you don't really know, you can't see the cause and the effect. And I think that here you kind of accentuate it nicely that, yes, what's happening around that.
So the reason The reason it precipitated my move to Australia was that I couldn't find a job in the UK. So I was offered one here, and I thought, hey, the sun shines, the beaches look good, I'll give it a go.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody's careers are a bit of a sort of coincidence in some way or another, and the context plays a role in that. But yeah, that's we continue a little bit about the subcontracting that you already mentioned. This kind of the new arrangement of work that's taking place through platforms, for example. We talk about also fragmentation of work, subcontracting, hybrid work, and individualized project-based tasks. We see in our data that we've been collecting recently that when we ask people about hybrid work, they talk about hybrid work, but when you look at what they actually do, they just sit home alone. So it's like, it's not hybrid. They don't go around. They stay in one place. It's just home. They not with other people. What do you think in terms of one of the things that's worrying the companies, for instance, that we work with and people that are conscious of the changing working life, what's worrying them greatly is the sort of shared reality, the common experiences and the sort of, or what we all know is improving all jobs, the sharing, the social, the being together. So how do you feel, what do you think, how can organizations still foster common experiences? How can we, is organization losing its purpose altogether?
Organizations, I mean, let's start from basics. The modern concept of an organization is the legal individual. It's a legal fiction that assumes that an organization is an individual. That enables that legal fiction to enter into contracts of various kinds with people and other entities, often contracts with other legal fictions. So what we have seen is a decline in the number of contracts entered with individuals and an increase in the number of contracts that organizations tend to create with other legal entities. A very good example of this is, say, Apple, which is actually not such a huge organization if you look at what goes on in Cupertino. But could it succeed? Could it be an organization without the Foxconn million employees in China and elsewhere that provide all of its parts? No, it couldn't. So are they part of Apple? Well, not legally, but the relation is so symbiotic, so integral, so interpenetrated that it would be impossible for that not to be the case. Then there's the question that you raised about working at home or working in the organization. A lot depends on the nature of the work. For many, you know, many creative workers, I mean, it was Virginia Woolf who wrote about the importance of a room of her own, having a room of one's own. I spent in my life writing, and so I, you know, which is a creative exercise. And this space that you see me in is the room where I do most of it. I still go into my office. Well, I don't have an office at work. I go into the open plant space at work, maybe once, sometimes twice a week, but not much more than that. And I think if I look at many of my colleagues, they have a similarly disaggregated relationship with the office. I mean, they're there on days for meetings, or we always have, we have kind of like a social day on Tuesday where everybody meets and has lunch together, so everybody can catch up. And when, you know, there's all the digital affordances that come through the screen, which enables you to connect. The kind of creative worker, though, tends to be not the normal person working on organizational routines, because essentially being an artist, a painter, a sculptor, a writer, a musician, all of those are very creative activities. They're activities that can be done in conjunction with others, but are usually done in rehearsal and in practice on one's own. The necessity for social interaction is much more intense when the nature of the work is much more routinized. And the essence of organization is to drive routines as far into the system as possible. And so what makes the routines bearable and tenable are the social interactions that are engaged in and around the work. We've known this ever since Donald Roy told us about banana time in that lovely little ethnography from, 70 years ago or so. So to the extent that organizing becomes permanently distributed and the people at the end of the distributed organizing are engaged in highly routine activities, I think it's not a very healthy situation because they're only focused on the screen, on the work, on meeting the very, very demanding systems of surveillance which are coming through the screen and touching and coming through the keyboard or monitoring the keyboard. And so the opportunities for that social engagement are limited, A, because there's usually no one else around when you're doing this because, you know, you want to keep the kids out of the room and, you know, everybody else may be out working somewhere else. So the health consequences of this, both in terms of bodily health, in terms of not moving around, not exercising, not walking from one place to another very much, and the mental health of being socially disengaged from those forms of situational society in which one is ordinarily embedded, I think are not positive. So again, it's a little bit like I've been just working on a paper today, sent off to the journal this morning, another paper on artificial intelligence. So you can't, you know, you can't close the door on this stuff. Things are not going to go backwards. But we have to take some care as to how we do it. So increasingly, there are moves. Some moves are fairly draconian. Some organizations are demanding that people come into the office 5 days a week. Other organizations are setting a sort of minimal office attendance. Maybe not statutory, but perhaps normative. And I think for as long as we are employed by organizations, working for organizations, then it is important to maintain the social integration. Social integration is an often neglected aspect of organizational analysis. There's a great deal about systems and system integration, but not so much about social integration. But without processes of social integration, the system integration will come a cropper, I suspect, one way or another.
Yes.
So the question.
Yes, it does. I think it's interesting, but I also think that what you're kind of raising there, what we also think about a lot in our team is that, like you said, you can't go back and work has always been changing. And these discussions on what's going to disappear and what's going to be destroyed have always been taking place at the breaking points of industrial revolutions. And now we're just, you know, if you look back, we can see the same discussions taking place in when different technologies have entered.
Well,
so in some ways, yes.
It's almost as if history's gone into reverse in some ways. Because if you talk about the Industrial Revolution, I grew up in the West Yorkshire, the West Riding of Yorkshire, which was the heart of the Industrial Revolution. This is where wool textiles were developed, were exported to the world. But I know from the villages around where I grew up that the earliest forms of weaving were actually done as domestic labor. There was something called the putting out system. What we have today is kind of like a modern version of the putting out system, where somebody perhaps on contract works on something at home and it, because a merchant gives them material to work, they work on it. Well, this is how the woolen industry was organized. before the merchants accumulated a little bit of capital and decided that, hey, if we put all of these people together in a factory, a manufacturer, that's what they used to call it in the 17th century, then, I'm sorry, the 18th century, then we can exercise a little bit more control over them. Because one of the problems with the putting out system was that you couldn't control the pace of work because it was not under surveillance. Nobody was watching it. You couldn't then control the quality of work because the work was produced as pieces, and then I'll come on to the pieces in a minute or two. Putting labor into fat manufactories, which were initially powered by water with water mills, and then subsequently with steam in steam mills, meant that the merchants become capitalist entrepreneurs could exercise far more control over the labor process than they had previously. And there's a wonderful real testament to this in the town adjacent to the small town in which I grew up. I grew up about 3 miles from a place called Halifax in Yorkshire. And in Halifax, there is something called the Peace Hall. Now, it's not a peace hall in terms of war and peace. It's a peace hall in terms of pieces, because this was almost Italian-age structure, which consisted of lots and lots of small rooms in which the merchants would put the pieces which they had collected from the weavers up in the hills, in the Pennine Hills around there, and they would take them to market and sell some. You go on Google, you can see pictures of the Peace Hall. It was renovated with the European Union money, which, of course, because of part of what we're all talking about, is no longer available to the good citizens of the UK. And it's a very impressive building.
Yeah, I will go and have a look. But I agree that we can. What I'm thinking also is that we could learn a lot by looking back and kind of looking at what's happened before when work has changed drastically, when new technologies have come and changed the logics of organizing or managing. And I think that we should be spending a lot more time in thinking about how to do this. You also mentioned that taking care of like different kinds of work, different kinds of labor, different kinds of technologies, how to divide the work. And I think that technology researchers, of course, were criticizing us all the time for saying that you are so critiqueless, just taking everything without really thinking of how. And I think that this lessons from the past would be a fruitful way of trying to do things in a more sustainable way. Yes, someone's asked you a question about Finland. Well, not really Finland, but the Nordic model. And I know that you're a fan. You mentioned that already. So I'll read out the question as it is sent to me. Finland has a tradition of strong worker protections, emphasized security and stability in both workplaces and society. How does this slow-moving Nordic labor regime align with today's fast-paced fluid economy? In balancing these traditional structures with emerging needs, are there potential innovations or new directions we risk overlooking? And I guess this is kind of the same what we just touched on. It's not just bad. It could be good, but what would that good look like?
Oh, well, I can only speak in very general terms. I've been to Finland a couple of times, but I'm certainly no expert. What I find important in the various Nordic countries that I'm familiar with, and I'm familiar with them all to some extent, is a strong tradition of workplace democracy, a strong tradition of co-determination, a strong tradition of fairly flat relations in terms of hierarchies.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That an absence of imperative command and more a meeting of different agents and agencies to try and derive a consensus about the ways to go forward. Now, there is no a priori reason why those positives, which you think they are positives, and I think they are positives, there's no a priori reason why those positives should disappear in a fast-moving digitized world. It's that, in fact, in many ways, digitization produces produces affordances that can make these things happen better. What depends, what's vital here is political will and political spirit. Mm-hmm. If the will to protect what is there as a legacy of positivity, if that will is relaxed, then many rapacious interests, which will not necessarily have the interests of democracy at a workplace and organizational level in mind, will take advantage of it. And whether that happens or doesn't happen, will happen or won't happen, I don't know. I'm not a soothsayer. I don't believe in predictions. So no. I don't know what the future holds. But I do think there are reasons to be cheerful and reasons to be cautious. We've talked about the reasons to be cautious already. So.
But what about the reasons to be cheerful? What were the possible opportunities for innovation, economic growth? Because it seems to me that it's what this question is getting at. Also, it's like a balancing act. That there's a lot of advocation from micro entrepreneurs and small business owners, but then having said that, it's proven difficult in this Finnish setup as well. So kind of like thinking in terms of traditional structures if we instead of thinking of things as like good or bad and the traditional good and new bad, we try to think both and. Then what could be the new opportunities, the reasons to be cheerful in the liquidization, in the fragmentation, in the fluidity? Can we look in the history? Is it something else? What do you think?
There's a book which has been quite influential in political economic circles in recent years, or at least sort of social democratic ones, by an Italian political economist, Massu Carto. And she talks about the mission economy, and she looks at the way in which the NASA as a mission was capable of achieving so many great things. And she argues in her work that we need to have an enabling state once again. And the green transition affords an opportunity for such an enabling state, because there are many opportunities for innovation at a local level, which, if it's able to access funding and support from the state, if it's able to build networks using the affordances of the state, could probably be much more successful than if it could not. So maybe there is a potential marriage between social democratic enabling states focused on missions such as building a green economy, a green society. And there is no more profound mission than that of saving the species and the planet from, roasting. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are some possibilities, but I don't think it can come from one side or the other side. I think you have to try to have a fusion of two. Yes.
And right now, like you said, the political climate is not really. It doesn't really look like the...
It will change. I mean, the thing about politics is that events happen, things change, and they change very rapidly. Mm-hmm. I mean, so in 4 years' time, there'll be another election in the United States, and who knows what will happen then? And, I mean, the United States is so important because it sets it sets the tone for the rest of us,
Right.
just about. Regrettably, they don't have elections, or they do have elections, but they're sham in some of the other larger economies. Your near neighbor, for instance, which
Yes.
must be quite threatening living next door to your near neighbor.
Yeah, I guess we're used to it. We try not to think about it. Can't focus on it, because then you just become frozen. But yeah, I think you're right. And I think that here again, we can, if we look back, we can see that the history has always gone in waves, that you have the rise of fascism. And then after that, the different kind of period. It's just that we had a long period of peace here in between of certain kind. And I guess you're right. And that's one thing to focus on, is feeling somehow down.
Well, certainly, if we think of, you know, the long waves, then the long wave, the long arc of neoliberalism is clearly in recession now. Now, where it will go, where it will end up, is unclear. On the one hand, we've got, you know, the mission economy prospects of people like Mazzucato, which the Starmer government in the UK are weakly behind, which the EU is. If it ever really got its act together, I think would be behind. But then you've got the kind of, you know, the retro mercantilism that's characteristic of Trump, and the many acolytes that, you know, the Bolsonaros, it was now thankfully gone, and the guy in Argentina, and the Hungary, Orbán. So, you know, there is a choir that sings a chorus to the Trumpian melodrama. So, I mean, we don't know where that will end up. We have to be optimistic, because we have to be optimistic.
I agree. We already touched on the hybrid and flexible models of work. But now this is more like directly on your work. The rise of hybrid and flexible work models is challenging the traditional thinking around organizational structures. What's your view in how organizations can maintain collective purpose and solidarity in the sort of fragmenting setup?
Well, there's a dual process occurring, which is one of both decomposition and recomposition. So it's important not just to focus on either side of that dialectic, because things never stay the same. They're always changing. They're always decomposing and recomposing. And we have to be able to analytically try and pull out what the threads of decomposition are, what the threads of recomposition are. And there's no point the important point is that it's always in process. So whatever the situation may be today, it won't be like that at some point, any point in the future, near or far. Things are always changing. And so our thinking always has to be changing too, because the whole point of being a social scientist is to reflect on the changing realities that one is living in and through, or looking at the changing realities that one and others have lived through. Because I think a historical organizational perspective is very important, as well as a contemporary one.
I think that's just a challenge in terms of the organizational realities, because people like to think that things stay the same when you look in the sort of...
Many, many years ago, when I was first thinking about these things, a paper I wrote in 1981 in the ASQ, it came out of a book I wrote the previous year. I mean, the paper didn't come out of the book, but the ideas did. I used a geological metaphor. It seemed to me that organizing is a sedimentary process. There are sediments of the past that they may not be visible. They're not on the surface. But they still inhere in the processes. You know, if we dig deep enough, we find elements of Taylorism and scientific management in contemporary organizations and contemporary work. We tend to think of something that happened at the beginning of the 19th, of the 20th century, the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, but it's pervasive and it's endured. It's changed as well, but its traces are still evident.
So, in other words, like kind of realizing that, I guess, am I interpreting you right if I say that you're kind of saying that it's not either or, it's both and. It's like the solidarity is the fragments, at least, of it remain. And as we look at organizations as a process, liquid process maybe, but still a process that's always changing, has always been changing. So it's not the question of something being gone and something starting, but all these elements being there and maybe some of them getting more attention, more weight at the given situation, but then having faith in that they don't go away, even if we sometimes hope that they would.
And I think that's absolutely right. And you know, both and is to index paradoxes. And I think when you do have you have dialectical processes of decomposition or recomposition going on, tensions arise and paradoxes will follow. And thinking of the social construction of reality through the lens of the paradox is, I think, quite fruitful and useful. It's one that I've used on a number of occasions with colleagues.
Yes, agreed. Well, a few more questions, and then we start wrapping up for today. On your circuits of power in modern organizations, you highlight the interplay between rules, agency, and structures. How could, or what's your idea of this framework helping us to understand the challenges and opportunities posed by gig work and platform-based economies?
Well, firstly, circuits of power wasn't in the book Modern Organizations. It was in the framework. It was in Frameworks of Power. Mm-hmm. And I published a second edition of that last year. And I use the model a lot in the new concluding chapter on a history of the present, where I looked at some contemporary concerns. The contemporary concerns that I looked at were COVID-19, the climate crisis, and the war in Ukraine. I think that the model worked very well. Let me just say a little bit about the model itself.
Yeah,
I mean,
please.
Sometimes gets misunderstood. Some people seem to have understood it as because I drew a diagram with three levels or layers in it, although I never called them levels or layers. They assume that it's a structural model. It's not a structural model. It's a processual model. And there's no hierarchization between the different circuits. The circuits are, in my mind, flowing together. Flows do flow together, and the circuits flow together. That was a major break with all the prior theorizing about power, which had been heavily influenced and came to a conclusion in Stephen Lukes's work with the notion of there being three dimensions to power. Well, I developed the circuits model as the antithesis of the three dimensions of power, because I wanted to say that we're not dealing with structure, we're not dealing with, and I didn't want to arrive at the point at which I accuse Lukes of arriving at, as preserving his liberal decencies while eating his Marxist cake, because he basically smuggles in a conception of false consciousness when he talks about real interests. The third dimension of power operates when people don't realize what their real interests are. Well, that's the German ideology. That's 19th century Marxism, and it's profoundly disrespectful to everybody who may not agree with the theorists. So it's a theoretically very arrogant position. I didn't want to embrace such a position. But I do believe that we're all practical theorists, and there's my ethno-methodology coming out again. We're all engaged in practical theorizing in the world. And as part of that, we try to structure situations, contexts, organizations, relations in general, in ways that suit our interests, that are advantageous to us. And to do this, we try to enact what in the philosophy of science is called standing conditions. Standing conditions are what make experiments work. It's standing conditions that ensure that the water that you're using is distilled, that the acid is pure, that the test tube is not contaminated, that the vacuum chamber is completely vacuumed, doesn't have any air. So I think we're practical experimentalists relationally, trying to construct the standing conditions that will enable us to maintain or to achieve those kinds of relations that we want to do. And a lot of organization is like that. Organization consists of trying to stabilize a set of standing conditions, of structural constraints, which they're structural constraints rather than structural enablements. They're forms of rule, forms of regulation, which try to fix us in positions and in place. But I wanted to show that a theory of power has to be both a theory of social order. How is social order possible? And if it's a theory of social order, it also has to be a theory of social change, because you have to ask the question, how is social disorder possible? Why do things change? How do things change? And I argued that the most economical way of exercising power is precisely what everybody from Hobbes onwards had identified. It said the A is getting the Bs to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. It's a causal relationship. But those causal relationships have a lot of architecture around them, which I've just been talking about. But also, they also need to be knitted into a circuit of facilitative power and a circuit of dispositional power. And the circuit of facilitative power is about it's about the ways in which meaning is made and fixed. It's about the way in which meanings can be refixed. I use the metaphor of fixing. I took it from photography, where you fix a negative into an image. Because I like the fluidity of that metaphor. Nobody would understand it these days because we don't use negatives in any images, but that's where it came from. Changes can come there through changes in sense-making, changes in meaning, which will fix what I took from Calonne, obligatory passage points. For example, we've just seen with the Trump election a massive turn against what the Americans call the DEI industry. But the DEI industry had fixed a whole set of obligatory passage points organizationally in terms of gender, ethnicity, sexuality. Those obligatory passage points are likely to change now. They changed to institute DEI. They're likely to change. They're probably already changing now. So what's happening there is that sense-making is making a different sense of the meanings that have already been established. But there are also forms of innovation that can occur, where you get changes in disciplinary techniques, changes in the things that matter. And the things that matter can change as a result of highly, wholly unpredictable events. And I, in the original version of Frameworks of Power, I took as my example of that the spread of the bubonic plague in Europe in the 14th century, which changed the balance of power between feudal lords and peasants. And that the Norwegian rat, the Rattus norvegicus, which carried the plague virus, decimated the European population by about 50% in some places, changed the balance of power. It was the rat, the flea, the virus. They were actors, really, really important actors. So I'm also quite influenced by actor network theory, as you can see. So I wanted to construct a way of thinking about the world, which would enable me to include all of those things. And so that's what I did. I think I call the actors, the external actors, the unknown actors, exogenous environmental contingencies. I don't really like that term anymore. I prefer to think of them as unknown actors. But the COVID virus, of course, is another great example of that. And I wrote about that in the most recent edition. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what the question was.
No, that's okay. You're opening this up really well and will be interesting for the listeners. Yeah, what we're getting at is that if you think about this framework now that you've nicely illustrated here, how can this help us understand the sort of challenges and opportunities that we're now facing in this gig work platform-based economy?
One of the papers that I wrote during COVID was with a colleague from Portugal and another colleague from the United States. It was about a platform called OSMX, which was the open source medical supplies. In the early stages of the COVID virus, hospitals supply things like face masks and gowns, surgical gloves on a just-in-time process. But in a virus, when we know what the contagion was like, just-in-time ceased to work. So the OSMS platform was something that was innovated as an open-source platform and very, very quickly had pulled in thousands of fab labs and small entrepreneurs who were producing, turning their gin factories into spirit factories to make, whatever it is you wash your hands with during COVID, surgical spirit. Similarly, they began to develop masks and eyepieces and gowns. Now, the problem was, how do you do this? Well, the web became a clearinghouse for designs, and the designs could be tested and authorized as being ones that had a degree of legitimacy. And it was an enormously important actor in the early stages of COVID, because it managed to get safe and secure personal protective equipment to first responder workers, which probably will have saved some of their lives. And so that's a really good example of how the platform economy can work, because the platform economy there brings in all of these communities of practice, which are distributed globally, supplying local markets, because it's that they're not huge corporations, that they don't have a supply chain. They don't have shipping contracts. So they're working very much at the level of the local market, but they're getting what's necessary and needed to the places where it's needed, and they're doing it quickly, and they're doing it to design specifications that work pretty well. So that's a very democratic and I think inspiring use of the platform economy. But conversely, as I said earlier, the platform economy can become a space in which it's someone like Elon Musk would argue that X, as he now calls Twitter, is a platform that respects freedom of speech, that freedom of speech is his raison d'être, because anybody can say anything on the platform. But it produces a a sewer of misinformation and disinformation, of bile, of viciousness, of intolerance, of nonsense, of people's personal truths, which is just nonsense. I mean, so it's there's nothing inherent in the technology that means what the technology should be. The same technology can be used one way or it can be used another way. So the point of juxtaposing those two ways of using the same technology is to say, hey, it's not the technology that's the problem. It's how we situate it, how we use it, what kind of circuits of power we construct around it.
Fantastic. That's a really great closing statement. But I'm still going to ask you one more question that I'm going to ask everyone, which is basically that you've already kind of answered it. So you just revisit what you've said. I guess you've answered it because I'm asking everyone in the end that, okay, in the light of all of this and in the light of all of your hugely impactful and interesting work and organizing, like if you have, when you're looking forward and thinking of the ways work is now changing, are you a pessimist, an optimist, a realist, something in between, and why in terms of what the future holds for us in the world of work?
Oh, it depends on the time of day. That could be all of those things.
Yeah, I know. But if you choose one position for the final, yeah.
Well, I would hope to be an optimistic realist. I mean, to be a pessimistic realist is already almost to concede defeat. And I don't think that the job of the engaged public intellectual is to admit defeat, but it's to it's to be engaged and to try and do it with the best intellectual rigor and theoretical acumen that you can muster. And of course, there would be lots and lots of reasons not to be cheerful, but I can't remember how many reasons to be cheerful Ian Dury and the Blockheads had in that great song. But I'm sure that we could muster sufficient reasons to be cheerful to make us want to, like Jackson Brown's Pretender, get up in the morning and get it on again, you know, to do it all again. That's so important. You know, you have to have a degree of optimistic realism to want to keep on doing that. If you live in a state of pessimistic realism, there might be some day when you think, well, I just don't feel like getting up and doing it all over again. And that can be a very, 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 very evil thought, bad thought. Like it can lead to all sorts of depression and psychoses and suicides and things like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, you have to keep the spirits up. Be an optimistic realist.
Yeah,
temper the optimism of the realism.
And that also goes nicely with this, your previous thought on the terms of like technology in itself is not bad. It's how we apply it, what we do with it. So if we try to remain optimistic and cheerful, maybe we find ways of using the technology that are better for us. Maybe not. I don't know. But thank you so much for this super inspirational and interesting talk. I could continue a lot longer. I'm just thanking you a lot for on behalf of the association of all the students that have been looking forward to your podcast. And thank you so much. Thank you for listening. The podcast is in collaboration with Aalto's Future Work Project, the Finnish Association of Work-Life Research, and the Work 2030 program.